Welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howie Jacobson. Excited to let you know that you can now pre-order my new book, You Can Change Other People, The 4 Steps to Help Employees, Colleagues, Even Family Up Their Game. I wrote it with Peter Bregman, who is my coach teacher, my coaching mentor, and it's now available for pre-order. And when you pre-order, you get a whole bunch of fun, valuable bonuses, including 3 recorded demo conversations where we show you exactly how to go through the 4 steps with real people, and a 1-page cheat sheet so you can follow along. The book itself, when you pre-order, will arrive in your mailbox or inbox on September 22nd, 2021. Here's how to do it. Go to plantyourself.com/pre. That's just P-R-E, all lowercase. That will forward you to the page on the Bregman Partners website that has all the information about how to pre-order. Basically, you just order somewhere, either online or at your local independent bookshop, and you send us the receipt via email, and then you get your bonuses. So I'm really hoping that you will help me make this book a big success. I hope it will. You will find it very valuable, and that once you get it and read it, you'll use it and recommend it to others. And so if you've been listening to this podcast for a while and you have gotten value, this is a really easy way for you to give back. It would be a huge help. So again, that's plantyourself.com/pre, P-R-E, all lowercase. All right, let's get to today's show. I started the Plant Yourself podcast to participate in the conversation about how we could use plants instead of animals and animal products to feed ourselves. And today's guest talks about how we can use plants in place of really, 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 really dead animals, as in fossil fuels, as in really old dinosaurs and stuff like that, to fuel our future. Virginia Klausmeier is the CEO of and co-founder of Silvatex, this really cool nanotech company that I actually checked out to make sure this wasn't some sort of greenwashing, and it's not. She and her company are, as far as I know, the real deal. They're trying to make low-carbon batteries for electric vehicles. So I am as suspicious as anyone about technology and capitalism's ability to solve our civilization's problems, since I see technology and capitalism as 2 of the main causes. And I've also come to realize that we do need technological solutions, at least to buy us time and possibly to contribute to a future that we can't even imagine now. So if we can get all the gas guzzlers off the roads and off of the oceans and out of the skies and replace them with electric vehicles that are powered by batteries that are sourced from plants, well, I say woohoo. So we're going to hear all about it today in today's conversation. So without further ado, Virginia Klausmeier, welcome to the Plant Yourself podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, let's talk about changing the world. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about who you are and what you do. Just kind of set the stage.
Yeah, well, so I started a company about 8 years ago. So it's been in the making, starting off of some technology that my late father developed. And just a little bit about me that's useful for context. My background's been in science and then in business. And then I ended up taking some of these early developments that he'd been focused on to really change the world, and looking at it from a carbon lens. How do we massively change the carbon that is being out there today in all of our general everyday activities? So that's, it's kind of a small, not a small challenge to address.
Well, I want to come back to all that interesting stuff, but let's lay the groundwork around, like, what's the deal with carbon, right? We're hearing a lot about carbon credits, carbon neutrality, but, you know, it's a molecule, right? It's everywhere. Can you give us kind of a framework for understanding everything that you're thinking about carbon?
Yeah. And I think that the message has simplified around carbon, but really like methane and a lot of gases that come off of industrial applications and traditional transportation go up to the atmosphere and cause problems that result into climate warming and the cooling, the warming of the planet, which ultimately results into a plethora of problems that we're seeing. So on the West Coast, just to name a few that are very prevalent, you have the fires, crazy storms, the droughts that are occurring. And, you know, I think everyone in the world is starting to become pretty affected by the effects of climate change, which ultimately is a result from us humans being on the planet and our ways of living.
Uh-huh. And so is it just that there's so many of us that, you know, like occasionally, like, I'll want to have a fire in my backyard, get some fallen limbs and trees. And I'm worrying, like, am I destroying the atmosphere? But, you know, humans have done that for a long time, but there's just so many of us. Or is it that we're doing fundamentally different things?
I would say both. So I think that's why the problem is so big, because it's compounded by a number of variables. So one, you have a pretty, you know, the population's pretty populated and it's trending, you know, still in a significant way. There's some good and bad effects on that. But also, you know, each person uses a lot of energy and a lot of overall carbon emissions from the food they eat to the clothes they wear. You know, so these are really everyday acts from the water they drink to the light they turn on, and then the cars they get in. And so all of these pieces add up, and separate from just burning a fire, that fire is kind of the earliest source of energy, right? So if you were in a non-populated place and didn't have all the other things around you, like that we have in our normal everyday life, I would imagine that fire is pretty low carbon impact compared to all the other pieces that we have around us.
Okay. So I remember first being woken up to this when I watched Al Gore's documentary, Inconvenient Truth. And at the end, he's got like 11 things you could do. And they were like, change your light bulbs, put in low flow shower heads. It was like all of the onus was on the consumer, the end user of the product. And so a lot of us, you know, and then there was this book, 50 Things You Can Do to Save the Earth, you know, recycling, using cloth instead of plastic bags. And like you're focusing on an entirely different point in the supply and creation and use chain, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all those points that were made are really good. And I think the, you know, big value is it draws into making you as a consumer aware of your impact at small stuff that hopefully also makes you aware of the big stuff. So just to give you a sense, like the energy, energy as a whole, so lights and fuels, that makes up about like close to 75% of the carbon emissions globally annually. So, you know, consumer products are a big part, because a lot of energy goes into making them and moving them around, et cetera. But, you know, when you're actually looking at keeping people warm and transportation and all of those sort of other effects, those are really big pieces of the pie. And I would say a little bit less out of consumers' control initially.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, like, you know, when I go to the store and I buy food, it's packaged food, they'll have a nutrition facts label, and it will tell me how many calories, how many grams of fat, vitamins, things like that. But I really have no sense of the energy that went into, you know, the light bulb that I buy or the kiwi that I get. Is it because we don't, like, it's really hard to tell? Like, do those measurements exist, or, you know, like, we just don't get told? Like, I was reading the other day that, like, you know, it's probably better to use plastic bags than to buy a cotton made bag. And that you'd have to use the cotton made bag 7,000 times to, and I'm like, oh, but, you know, look at me with my cotton bag. I feel so virtuous.
Yeah, no, and you're completely, and that's the thing that, like, this is a challenging problem to understand. What I think you initially pointed out is some type of number or score of how much carbon was attached to that product, because I know the cost of it, it's not usually captured into the cost right now. So there are becoming more sophisticated understanding about, it's called like the life cycle. So you look at the life cycle of something from, you know, from the beginning of life. So did it use your generative planting purpose, you know, agricultural aspects, things like that. So it has a lower carbon footprint. And then does it, you know, and then is it local, et cetera. So all these things are starting to be factored in. I think we're pretty far away from the consumer actually getting an actual score on like a bag of chips, but mm-hmm. you're starting to see more brands, you know, that are actually doing a really good job on talking about their impacts on how they've mitigated any CO2 for that product. So you are starting to see a lot of products that are doing a great job with transparency, which is a, you know, it's a hard thing to do. It takes money and energy to do that. And one of the things kind of to that point that's pretty interesting is you're starting to see the automotive industry do the same. So they're looking at, eventually when you buy a car, you'll see the carbon impact of that car.
Hmm. I imagine there must be some sort of resistance to being the first person, the first company to announce it. Like I'm thinking about like when I read about like this pound of almonds took 32,000 gallons of water or something to produce. Like I have no frame of reference for that. That sounds like a hell of a lot, you know, but then, you know, you compare it to beef or lentils or something else. But like for companies to be the first ones to go out there and say like, this is how much carbon our product is using might like be a PR nightmare for them.
You know, it could, but usually the people that are highlighting the problem are the ones that have actually a solution. So that's, you know, that's, so I think that that's good. And that's also part of it is that there needs to be more awareness and more support in organizations that do take that direct transparency approach, because they are really highlighting the problem and trying to show how they're addressing it from their angle or their piece of it. Mm-hmm. But you're completely right. You know, I think one of the things that's hard to do is really figure out how to market to a large sort of the like broad consumer on these confusing, complex topics.
Right. I mean, the other thing I'm thinking is that most of the things that I have overtly done to be better, to contribute less to climate change have been costly to me, whether it's a trivial cost like $5 for a bag or, you know, taking, you know, shorter showers or turning down the thermostat. Like they're virtue things that I do at some sacrifice. And I'm, you know, like, I don't think that's how the world changes. Right. Cause even like there's not enough people in a position to do that, you know, just to a certain extent, I feel very privileged in that I can take these steps and it doesn't materially affect my quality of life. But I'm wondering, with like, you have a company that's trying to solve these big problems. Is there a way to make climate remediation profitable so that that people want to do it, companies want to do it because it's better for them and it's not just, virtue signaling?
Yeah. And there's been a really big pivot. So I think that like just sort of taking your example that you offered, you know, when you're looking at taking a shorter shower or using less, you know, turning off some lights that in general might feel like it's you're taking away from your quality of life. You're also saving money. And one of the things is actually looking at that cost savings differential and valuing that. So the water and the real cost of what it takes to provide that water and the real cost of what it takes to provide that energy is going to start coming up to the consumer. So it's actually better for you to use less of those less of those things. And so we're starting to see a pretty big pivot point where renewable energy and renewable, you know, materials, you could say just the right choices or like the lowest impact are starting, you know, the people have been working on this stuff for decades. You know, my father worked on it for decades before I did. And you're starting to see those solutions become at least on par with already existing like basic petroleum chemical solutions or other things like that, or in some cases even be cheaper when it comes to energy. So there's a really big turning point that's exciting and really catalyzing a lot of investment for scale up in this space now.
Yeah, right. Although I once made the mistake of calculating how much money I saved by turning off lights. And it comes out to, you know, pennies a year. And at the same time, my energy provider, Duke Energy, is polluting the hell out of my state, right?
Yeah.
They've got, you know, they've got these ash and runoff into lakes and streams. And so there's if I wanted them to pay for that, like my energy would be a lot more expensive, but because so much of economics is on these externalities that the companies don't have to pay for, and therefore I don't have to pay for, there's no real sense of gain, even, you know, because the money I'm saving is so minuscule, because I'm, you know, I may end up paying for it in terms of disease later on, or, you know, health insurance premiums, or, you know, crappy food. Do you see a movement in the business world towards accounting better for all the harms?
Yeah. And one of the things, I'm just going to take that because that was a really like tangible example, is, you know, when you look at your local energy provider that's using all this dirty energy and polluting your local environment, you're also losing because you lose that access to that beautiful environment, right? So there's, I think, in people's awareness to those effects are becoming a lot stronger. Most, you know, a big account for it could be that people had to stay home and increase their awareness of what's happening around them, and you know, and they had to stay more localized, and then they started to say, "Huh, this isn't, you know, this looks pretty toxic. I can't swim in that river. That's not okay. Why not?" You know, and they started to ask more questions. So the impacts to communities are significant, and you are starting to see changes in weather patterns and things like that that are really tangible that are affecting most people at different levels, but it is a little bit more removed. You don't immediately say, "Oh, I'm going to turn off my switch and then I'm not going to have a fire that's, you know, all summer long," right? That's not how, it's not that direct. But, you know, I do, there is a pretty big shift that's happening, and it comes really starting from the money sources. So a lot of money sources are pushing for, large organizations to have an awareness around their environmental effects and to actually be mitigating them or accounting for them in some way. A lot of really large money, you know, the sort of money that moves all the economy, like BlackRock, et cetera, really see if you don't have if you don't have a solution to have that's cleaner burning or things like that, and less polluting, then you're not going to survive, right? So that's not where the future is going, is to pollute more. That's not where I think anyone believes is true. But like the sort of problem is we do need to have good solutions that are much cleaner and, you know, potentially even lower in cost to really have that double win for the consumer and also for the economy and our long-term change.
Gotcha. Well, I think that segues us nicely into your company, Silvatex, right? Which is doing stuff, right? You're creating the technologies so that these impulses don't just have to stay wishes. So tell us just maybe briefly, like what are the technologies that you're working on?
Yeah. Well, so again, we're a climate tech company. So we're focusing, and we've looked at solutions. The lens we use is, where can we make the biggest impact? So overall, how can we significantly reduce carbon emissions? So we've tackled the energy sector, which is, I mentioned, accounts for almost 75% of the carbon problem. And we've been using all of our sustainable chemistry platform, which I, you know, let's unpack that. It's pretty much empowered by plants. So what we did was we used biomaterials, so all plant-based materials to do chemistry. So instead of doing using more traditional chemicals that come from petroleum and oil, we use regenerative materials and we apply them to areas that can really enable a significant change. So our whole lens has been one, we need to empower solutions that massively reduce carbon, but also we don't assume that people will pay more. They actually have to pay significantly less to adopt the solutions. And we've applied our technology to EV battery materials,
What's
to
EV?
massive EV, sorry, the electric vehicles. So changing into the sector of electric vehicles and really making the battery materials in a much, much more efficient way. So they're much lower in cost, but also have a lot lower carbon footprint.
Gotcha. So let me unpack, make sure I understand this. So it's the idea of sustainable chemistry from plant-based sources is that like you can grow plants again and again, whereas it takes a lot longer to grow shale oil or petroleum, right? Like, you know, like millions of years, right? For
Yeah,
that
it's not
process.
considered regenerative.
So that by using plants, you can You don't, we don't, we can keep oil in the ground.
Correct.
Right. And so like when I first heard about like, you know, plant-based energy sources, it was in the context of biofuels, right? Like, hey, let's just burn them. And I've seen a lot of analyses that suggest that maybe, you know, corn for biodiesel or ethanol is not the greatest thing in the world. Is this what you're talking about, or are you talking about like something fundamentally different?
Something fundamentally different, but similar in scope. So, biofuels are, if you look at the full life cycle analysis of the carbon from growth to processing, like to actually burning, they are better compared to conventional, but they're still not the best. So, you're starting to see a movement away from even liquid fuels for automotive vehicles into electrified vehicles so that you don't have the tailpipe emissions that come out every day as we fill our vehicles.
Okay, so then what does it look like to turn a pl to have to you know plant chemistry? Like, what are you turning the plants into?
Yeah, so and I apologize because this is, you know, our approach is definitely looking at impacting big industrial applications. So most people don't have, you know, a common sense around that. But what our technology does is we use plants to really build molecules together at a nano scale. So we use sort of the power of science to make that happen. And we're right now applying it so that the materials that are in batteries usually take a lot of energy to make, and they can use a lot of water and are not as efficient. And our chemistry allows them to be much, much more efficient of a process. So it's not that it's bio-based, is really the factor. It's sophisticated science, but and so that's what's unlocking the benefits. But we think it's really important that it has to be bio-based so that we're not sort of solving the problem with something that is also going to be depleting.
Gotcha. So we're not talking about like potatoes, pennies, and lemon juice batteries.
No, exactly. Nope.
Okay.
Yeah, we're talking about Tesla's batteries. You know, all of the major OEMs that are making their batteries and making it so that their vehicles and their batteries are made in a much more efficient way.
Gotcha. So what are the compounds now that are expensive and environmentally costly that are going into batteries and being depleted?
Well, the biggest thing that you probably hear about is when you're looking at the battery, especially lithium-ion batteries, what's being used for the foreseeable future is mining these materials can, one, it's not regenerative. So again, you're mining a resource that's finite, and that's like lithium and nickel and cobalt. So you're hearing about all these materials. The process of turning them into the materials that are used in the battery takes a lot of steps, and also there's a lot of waste. In our using our chemistry, we're able to massively increase the efficiency and reduce that waste substantially. So we're making the materials come together in a much more effective way. And the sort of holy grail is actually using recycled materials. So you're using end of life batteries after they get recycled, all the nickel and the lithium that comes out, you're putting that back into the process so that you have a full closed loop system is how they think about it, which is that's definitely the holy grail when you're looking at being really renewable and really regenerative.
Okay. So help me understand the idea of nanomolecules, nanoparticles, right? My brain obviously can't picture it. But is the idea that we now have the technology to reduce things to such fundamental levels, to the individual little Legos, that we can build anything?
Somewhat, yeah. I mean, the whole innovation with batteries has been really groundbreaking, where the lithium ion is going back and forth is what's creating the energy that's allowing the movement of the vehicle or, the lights to turn on, et cetera. So it really, the energy source is down to a molecular level always. It's just how you get that energy back and forth. Lithium has done is a really good energy source. And from developments and innovation over the last, quite honestly, 20 years, these batteries have gotten much, much, much more efficient so that we can start to use them in vehicles and for other energy sources safely.
Okay. So the lithium still has to be mined, right? So is there
Mined
a
or recycled.
recycled? Okay. So it's a non-renewable resource, but I guess it could be,
You can
recycled.
recycle, yeah, so yeah.
But I mean, like, does the same amount of lithium in the battery at the end of its life as the beginning?
No, you do have some, you definitely have some loss. There's a lot of work that is being done in the industry to try to really do some of the recycling in a much more efficient way so that you reduce as much loss. But one of the things that's really important is as the market, so you're seeing all of the major OEMs, so the OEMs are the car manufacturers, BMW, VW, Ford, are really having electrified future. So that means all of their vehicles are going to be electrified by 2030, 2050. Everyone has a different roadmap. And for that to be true, we as an industry needs to make sure we mine those materials using them really efficiently and we produce them in a much more effective way so that again we don't create more problems for globally with solving it in with integrating a new solution.
Gotcha. But are we close to the point where we can make lithium out of air or no?
No. I mean, in lithium, I mean, I don't think that there's actually, I mean, lithium is its own mineral. So it definitely has to come from something, but you can recycle it very well, right? So it's its own molecule. So it's not gonna, you can't actually just synthetically make it, at least to date. I've never heard of anyone being able to work on that yet, but that maybe is in the future.
Okay, because I was reading recently about like this idea of like biodigesters producing all our food, like at the molecular level. Like, here it's a chicken, made by these fermentations. So I'm wondering how nano we can start to get around putting quarks and nuons and electrons together to make whatever we
Yeah,
want.
And food, you definitely can. I mean, energy is a little bit different than food, because food definitely is carbon. You know, at the base of everything is pretty much carbon. So you can build, like synthetic meats and things like that, which is what's happening a lot these days. And you can theoretically take carbon from the atmosphere or different places and create the carbon change in the molecules that make different food that we eat
I see.
today.
I see.
So you can, that is definitely coming out. Most of it is focusing on high protein sources. And of course it's easier to grow vegetables and things like that than synthetically make those. I don't know if that's ever going to be, that turning point is going to be say a wild one. Maybe on Mars that makes more sense to synthetically make it.
Even Matt Damon was growing real potatoes on Mars
Yeah.
in that movie.
Exactly. See, that's a really good point, is that, nature does a really good job. So the closer we can get back to nature, the better.
Well, I think that's the inspiration for the name of your company, right? Like Far Silva Forest Technology.
Exactly. Most people don't know that. Thank you.
So, well, I knew it as soon as I read it on your website.
Yeah, the one of the things that's fun is has definitely inspired us is using the power of nature to make these, new novel materials that are starting to be used and be synthesized, because it is making building blocks up from a ionic scale or a molecular level. So it is, it seems like space age stuff, but really it's pretty simple and pretty amazing, because the nature has been doing it for years very, very well.
Right. Well, nature's pretty space aged. I mean, you ever look at like a spider web? Like, I don't think we can make that yet.
Yeah, there has been companies that have made spider silk. So they've been, yeah, so they've mimicked the same type of, I mean, because when you look also at nature, it's also incredibly efficient. So if you're not efficient, you don't survive. And so nature has done, most of the time they do things very, very efficiently. They versus us, right? We're not natural. They are the natural. But yeah, so looking, there's definitely a lot to learn from biomimicry, from looking at what happens in bio and mimicking it in different applications. So that definitely is the way that we think. A broader scale, and then just applying it to these like huge industrial applications that usually are really polluting, and trying to figure out how can we constantly mitigate the approaches and think a little bit differently so that we can have a much better approach.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because the biomimicry, it clearly works on sort of small scales, because nature mostly operates in sort of small scales, but there's also, but like if you're trying to apply biomimicry to these giant systems that are human made, that are of scale much greater, but then I guess nature has huge scale as well. It's got climate, it's got the water cycle. Like
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at like even bees, for example, the amount of honey they make per their scale, and just the way that they do it, there's a lot of energy that goes into their process, and mushrooms, like there's just a lot of interconnected processes. And I think nature has done a really amazing job at creating a wonderful harmony between them. And us humans, we don't like to harmonize with one another. So, and that's, I think what, sort of going back to how you started to set up some of your reflections in this conversation, is that, it's kind of like we assume that we should have all of these benefits. We should have warmth, we should have light, we should have internet, we should have good working Zoom, we should have healthy food. Like these are, we make these assumptions, and it's kind of us versus them. But quite honestly, the whole very few people on the planet can live as most people in the US live today, and in other countries. So that's, it's definitely, we're not in harmony. This is my big point.
Yeah. So I kind of want to get to the sort of like the Marvel comic superhero angle to the story. It was like your father was working on this, and now you've taken over them. Like I can just see like the secret, Alfred lair with the test tubes, and you like, what was, tell me about your dad, what he did, and how it inspired you.
Yeah, I and looking back, it kind of was like that Marvel approach when I was younger, seeing him in the chemist outfit, and and it took me until probably my mid late 20s to really engage with what he was doing. Because most people, when your parents are your parents, you really don't really fully understand what they do and what impact they make. So it wasn't until I was in the world in kind of a big way that I really understood what he was doing. And he had a really interesting background where he started with municipal science. So he started looking at chemistry for making pharmaceuticals and things. And then he took a lot of those learnings and actually wanted to apply them more into the environmental space. So this is, late 70s, 80s. And so he transferred and went more into sort of this new world of bio-based regeneration. So he had a foundation from thinking about things at a pharma level, which is really at a nano level, and then and applying that into energy. So, he wrote papers with argon, which is one of the largest national labs and really game changing, on ways to create energy, from a full cycle, from a human has waste that they produce. How do you turn that into energy and like food that can be used on Mars? So that type of stuff, he definitely worked on over his career.
That's so interesting, because when I think about this late 70s and the energy situation, it was a lot of hippies, right? It was sort of past, post Earth Day, and this like, holding up signs against nuclear, against coal. But he sounds like, very sort of straight-laced, button-down scientist with sort of the same ethos and interests, but working at a very different level.
He was a big hippie though, too. So definitely part of that, but just and I think one of the things too that was nice is just through the stages of my early life, moved us to Thailand. So I think he had a pretty good global view. And then back to Eugene, Oregon, where he started to do more of quite honestly his garage work, which is where I kind of got involved. And that's where he started to do more of his development on looking at sustainable chemistry applications. He was applying it to the fuel sector. So to your earlier point, because that was really where there was a big shift away from full petrol-based fuels and into more of the system we have today and the next generation of those. So he was working on next gen fuels initially, which is where I got involved.
Gotcha. And so what was your initial involvement?
I mean, yeah, it was quite honestly an awakening that I just started to realize. People started to ask me a little bit more about my family, as I started to grow my career, my background, who's my family, what do they do? And I think of my dad as a hippie artist that's a really smart scientist, and we grew, so that was my frame. But then I started to ask a little bit more questions. What have you been doing? How has that been going? And I really learned that over the last decade, he had done a lot of deep science, and he was creating a fuel solution that not only uses sort of next gen materials, but could create a much lower emitting and much lower polluting diesel fuel. So, AKA, could change the world, right? And I decided to start helping him out. Through that process, I learned a lot and was really was able to get him like start getting some grants and funding, and use my network to really expand. And unfortunately, he got pancreatic cancer and passed away pretty abruptly. So that was a big pivot point for me in my life on
Sorry. Yeah,
questioning what to do.
sorry to hear that. When
Yeah.
was that? When did he die?
Yeah, and that was about a little over a decade ago.
So it was before you started Silvatex.
Yes. It took me a couple years to really understand the impact of what had been, you know, initially created. And for me, you know, I was on a completely different life trajectory, working in larger organizations, and had a really, I don't want to say like more standard, high, you know, traditional approach to life, and then quit all that and pitched in Silicon Valley and started my company the next day.
Wow. And it's been 8 years.
Yeah, it's been about 8 years. And we really initially launched with the focus of the fuel application. And through that, working with like the Department of Agriculture and a number of different institutions, we learned a lot more about the science that is allowing for some of the outcomes that we were seeing. And then that gave us really a different way to see the world. And a couple years ago, we took a really big look at where we could add a, you know, massive value, right, into the supply chains. Because most of these technologies, they're platforms, meaning you can do lots of things with them. So you really have to focus your attention on an area where you can add a lot of value. And for us, adding a lot of value meant something that we could create a lot of financial returns, but also massively reduce the carbon profile. So we started to take our technology and apply it to making these nanomaterials, knowing that that was an area that was going to grow with the growth of sort of the new energy future. And we really wanted to make sure those industries developed in such a way that they are, they're, you know, not becoming heavily polluting and they're very efficient, et cetera. So we really, I would say our bets paid off now, given that that industry is really blossoming, which is wonderful. And I think really good for the overall planet.
Yeah. Has Silicon Valley changed in the 8 years in terms of, like, let's say the valence they put on profits versus like saving the earth?
No, but I think that the way that the businesses has changed. So it's not save the earth or make profit. I think they are. You know, and you're starting to see this with a lot of money in big institutions, is that there is a strong belief that the future, you know, if you're trying to build something for them, you know, to be the game changing solution in the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, it has to be sustainable, meaning it has to be able to, like, you know, not pollute as much and have all these issues extract from the environment and communities as much, because generally that is not sustainable. So that is not going to be an approach that will survive in the growing awareness and government awareness with pollution and climate change, et cetera. So I do think that there's some big I do believe that there is some changing in mindsets at a pretty big scale.
So you started this company, was by yourself or with partners?
By myself. I definitely had some founding, I call them advisors. So a lot of supportive people that were incredible cheerleaders along the path and have been with me on this, you know, windy road, which I'm incredibly grateful for.
So, and you think of yourself as a, or at least when you started, you were the scientist, right?
I definitely know the science, but I quickly realized that my lane is more in the application of applying it in the business sector. So yeah, we definitely have had the pleasure of recruiting highly technical support.
Gotcha. So I'm curious about like your trajectory from founder with an idea based on your family's, you know, pedigree to becoming a leader. Like what challenges have you discovered and overcome on that path?
Wow. Okay. Let me simmer on that for a second, because it's been a lot. I think I'm just going to kind of give a few pivot points through mine. One was just starting the company. So for that, you know, one, I really quite honestly had to have significant loss in my life where it made me really think about what I want to do. And if I died tomorrow, would I be proud of the work I did? Or, you know, so those really big fundamental things, it's like struggles. Like I got that reflection moment with losing somebody so close to me and other loss that I had at that time period. So that point, That was a really big shift and struggle, but it empowered me to actually make, you know, really invest in the world I want to see and I want to live in. And that's been the foundation that I, you know, I move on every day. I want to talk to good people like you. I want to, you know, I want to expand in areas that are significant. So that was a really big shift, for me. And then there was, actually building the company and becoming a leader. For better or for worse, in my area, there's not very many women leaders that have traditionally been in sort of hard science, and in business combined. So I've really tried to attract to people that I can relate to, because, you know, gender is one thing, but I think it, you know, it does, it's valuable to see people kind of that you relate to, in positions that you want to go into. So that's been something that, you know, I've definitely tried to manage, but has probably been my personal struggle, has realized that, you know, it's not just the traditional people that you see that are the ones that can create change. I can do that too. And I can learn along the way, and I can, and I have the power. You know, we're all people, we all have the potential, right? So, really that humbling process, is a constant, yeah, a constant theme.
So do you, I'm really curious about this because there's, you know, in terms of like, you know, diversity and equity in the workplace, especially around, you know, around gender issues, there's been sort of a movement for women to be able to do whatever men do. To be, you know, and so, and of course, there's all the issues that go with that around like, am I being a boss or am I being bossy? Right, like the double standards. But I'm also beginning to see women taking leadership roles and saying, I don't have to do it the way men do it. And especially, you know, I'm wondering in this field in which, you know, in this sort of fundamental change, like. It feels to me a very feminine approach to say, let's look at nature and see what we can learn, as opposed to let's see what we can extract or control. And I'm wondering if you think of yourself as a leader who draws upon your experience as a woman in your leadership.
I mean, the short answer is yes. Like what I've learned and what all the research, you know, in human development tells us is the closer that you can become to yourself and your unique attributes and X factor, the more you're going to bring into the world, right? So I think it's been really valuable for people to settle in and be like, oh, I am a woman. Like that makes sense. I can add value as I am. I don't need to pretend. You know, or fit into this process that the world has been built around for a traditional, you know, I mean, traditionally more white male. So you're starting to see a shift of, you know, I wouldn't say it's, I don't want to be that. I think it's more like, oh, I'm much more effective as a human when I really am comfortable, being me and realizing that there's value being me, because, at least for me, there's, you know, about half of people on the planet like me. So that's a pretty big number. And then, you know, and then the more, you know, sort of taking that one layer further is that being a, you know, being a mom. So not only is it, you know, sort of taking the risks on the entrepreneurial journey, but then, it really was, you know, becoming a mother. And you know, I think that there's in the workplace, and especially right now, you're seeing a lot of women leaving the workplace because it does not work for them in their ability to be, you know, a manager at home and a manager, in their job and workplace. So you know, I'm really hoping that that's going to change, and people have, and that there's been a big spark of being able to create more equitability, for division of labor, so that we can have a broader diversity of, you know, perspectives and in the workforce.
Gotcha. And how about being a leader in your organization? You have to make tough decisions, right? You have to balance individual needs. What's that journey been like?
Every day it's a new journey, so that's one exciting that's definitely one exciting thing. You know, I think In the entrepreneurial journey, you definitely have to get really comfortable with making decisions with very little information, which is really uncomfortable. It's not what most people like to do. So I've gotten really comfortable, in that process. And that's, I think, applied well for also becoming a mom and managing a lot at home, because you just, there's really not usually one right answer. There's a lot of different paths to success. So it's maintaining that flexibility and being open-minded that I think has been really, really valuable. And I think for me, one of the big things that I've really, I don't want to say like learned, but I'm trying to manifest more of is the more, not just like pushing through with trying to make things happen, but the more that I allow the solutions to unfold and that I relax into each hurdle that applies, I am able to really shift my focus and come up with solutions on an easier bandwidth, if that makes sense. So yeah, one of my big themes is happy people are much more efficient. We know that they're about 33% more efficient. So whatever I can do to maintain happiness, I will be a better leader and a better person all the way around. So however I do that is good.
Gotcha. And it sounds like you're becoming more and more successful, and presumably you're gonna need to grow. What about your growing the leaders under you to be leaders? Is that a factor right now?
Yeah, completely. So, I mean, one, within our organization, spending a lot of time with, I mean, right now we have a pretty small organization, so it's fairly easy, but we definitely want to grow and expand that significantly as we start and incorporate that into our growth, is those models. And, a big part of it is real transparency, is meeting people where they're at. So, I'm happy you brought that up, because one of the plugs I wanted to make is a couple entrepreneur friends and myself started an award called the Pandemic Supermoms Award. And it's definitely focused on getting the stories out of people and how they managed through, which is part, was inspired by a lot of our employees that just did a really good job. And there's a lot of stories out there of how people have been able to kind of finagle doing it all and teach leaders like us on how we can do it better and how we can create a better work environment that allows that flexibility that's needed to manage through a pandemic and through parenting.
Have you been touched by the Great Resignation?
Definitely. Completely. I think, early on in the pandemic, we definitely saw that. And then in a lot of my cohort and just in my general personal life, I definitely have seen a significant amount of shifting within people, and specifically women in the work. I mean, it's been specifically from my anecdotal evidence, women, and also what you're seeing in the numbers more broadly.
So do you, are you able to attract and maintain talent right now? Is it hard?
Yes. We definitely had some shifting that occurred over the last 18, 24 months, which I think has been similar to a lot of organizations. The world changed so much. And what we're doing is trying to create a lot of flexibility within our in how people work to be able to account for how to manage their home life as well. So I think that that's been something that has attracted support. And I, I've heard my team at least acknowledge that they like the ability to work for somebody that's very open about their homes, their home personal life and just all the pieces, and try to sort of have a more of an empathetic leadership style. It makes them feel safer to talk about things versus just having it be binary, like you're working or you're not. Because we're, at the end of the day, we're all humans,
Right. So you mentioned the Pandemic Supermoms Award as something you wanted to highlight. Anything else you want to talk about that I haven't asked about?
This has definitely been a fruitful discussion, a lot. I look forward to hearing the response from your listeners. And I definitely would like to put that plug there, hopefully in the show notes or something, we can put a link to the Pandemic Supermoms Award. But you can nominate yourself, or you can nominate somebody else. You get a lot of, you get some money and goodie bags from women-based organizations. So definitely want to get as many of those stories out there. And our goal with the whole campaign is to highlight people and just their creativity of managing through and their resilience that, you know, being a mom really grows that skill, and being able to have it shine among leaders in the workplace to hopefully support more of the movements that allow flexibility and workability to get more women back into the workforce that we've seen.
Great. And for people who are not going to look at the show notes, is there a website for it?
Yes. So you can go to Cooley Cooley, their website, and look for the Super Moms campaign.
How do you spell that? Cooley?
Yeah, it's K-U-L-I, K-U-L-I.
Okay.
Cooley Cooley.
CooleyCooley.com and look for Super Moms.
Yeah. I think I spelled that right. Hold on 1 second. My apologies.
No worries. See, this is why people should always check out the show notes.
Oh, CooleyCooleyFoods.com.
CooleyCooleyFoods.com.
Super Moms. Yep.
Okay, great. So I'll definitely put that in the show notes. And that's an amazing thing to highlight and people to.
And also, one other thing is just pay attention to what's happening with COP26 and at local and you know, at your local level and wherever around climate change and environmental effects, because uh-huh. You know, change is here, and there's a lot happening in the communities from global level, like you're seeing at COP26, to down to domestic and everyone in their own community. So there's a lot that can happen and change. It's really exciting.
Awesome. So before you go, paint us a picture. So Silvatex is incredibly successful. What are we seeing in the world in 5 years?
I love that picture. So in 5 years, you're going to see that there's more like domestic production. So in the US, you're going to see, and you know, at every like sort of region locally, of batteries and vehicles that are going to be coming into the supply chain. And the reason why that matters is because it means that equals jobs, and that equals more sustainable energy and lower carbon profiles. And you're starting to see a transition from traditional energy to having energy storage that is taking place. So that really changes the actual emissions that are being emitted from coal and other types of traditional energy sources. And so you're seeing this sort of growth in the marketplace of these jobs, and all of that is done in a, you know, I like to use the word harmonious way. So all of those industrial solutions are somewhat closed loop, so they're not impacting sort of the localized communities where they're located and expanding. So that's kind of where we come in, and our dream and vision is really to bring us to that next generation solutions, but in a much more sustainable way. Gotcha. So for us, yeah, that means that we're expanded uh-huh. pretty significantly with that, all of those the new techs that are coming online.
Okay, and as the consumer, the end user, do I get better battery life? Is my car more powerful? Is it easier to charge? Is it easier to swap out when it's done?
Oh, great question. So you're going to have a much easier life. One is it's going to be lower. It's going to be cheaper. Two, you're going to be able to look at your vehicle and have a sticker on there, and it's going to say how much carbon it took to actually produce that vehicle. And it's going to be a lot lower than what it's been traditionally before. So you're going to have that clarity, and you're going to have all the performance elements that you're seeing. So right now in a lot of our government, there's been a big infrastructure change to support the growth of EVs. So it's going to be easier to plug in, easier to fuel up, lower in cost for you in a substantial way as the consumer, because you're not having to maintain buying this energy source and this fuel.
Gotcha. So my final question might be a little bit hardball, but there's a movement that I'm aware of that kind of really distrusts technology as mm-hmm. a solution, because they, you know, see, technology has always been the problem, right?
Yeah.
So we think about, like, you know, one way to solve transportation is public transportation. Another way is give everybody their own self-driving flying car. Right. And, you know, so yeah. Like, what do you see in terms of, like, can technology lead us to what you talk about, this sort of harmonious way of living on the world? Or is it just sort of, you know, shaving off the roughest edges of our capitalist ego-driven society?
Oh, yeah, that is a very loaded question. We could probably talk an hour about this question, but the way that I think about it is that we there's a lot of humans on this planet and we use a lot of resources. So we need to scale those back at a pretty significant level. So even though technology definitely can create more consumerism or have unintended effects, right, that we don't want to see, I'm definitely of the approach where we have to reduce the amount of energy we use. So that means, yeah, use the public buses, get people closer together so that we have much more efficient solutions. And that bus should be fueled off of electrification, and electrification should be coming from wind powered energy or different renewable resources, right? So it's sort of a hybrid of all of the solutions together, like stitching it all together, that makes the really big difference. It's good to be skeptical of innovations because traditionally they have been driven from of making money. And, you know, I think that there is going to be a lot of sort of side things that might not pan out, that have big hopes and dreams, but for us to make a big impact, we do need to be thinking more holistically about integrating like the solutions so that we move around in a much more efficient way. And then everything that fuels that has to be much done in a much more effective way as well.
All right. So all hands on deck, all approaches.
All hands on deck. Yeah. Maintain your skeptical ways, but make sure, you know, you start adopting and changing because it is definitely the time to start looking ahead and how you want to reduce your impact.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Last question. You're a scientist. You're a visionary. Are you hopeful?
I am very hopeful. Yeah, I am. I see a lot of change and I see a lot of amazing momentum with the younger generations, their awareness of the planet as a whole and the effects that we see on the climate is something that I've never seen before. And I really do believe that they're going to demand and drive that change they want to see for the world they want to live in. So I am hopefully part of that. And I am very hopeful that the momentum is here and is maintained.
All right. Let's go out on that note. Virginia Klausmeier, thank you so much for the work you're doing, for carrying on your father's legacy, for, helping to heal the world, and for taking the time today.
Definitely. Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, really grateful for this opportunity. Thank you for listening.
Yep, you bet. And you can check out the show notes for today's episode at plantyourself.com/490, 490, just 10 shy of 500. Hope you enjoyed it. I hope you were inspired. And we just talked to someone who thinks there's hope for our planet, for our climate, for our species. So cool. I'm going to keep that in my back pocket on those days when I wake up not feeling so hopeful. Let's see, in movement news, huge weekend for me. I was down in Sarasota competing in the world's Grand Masters of Ultimate Championships, and I had a great time. I played well, and all the running and lifting I've been doing definitely kept my body from falling apart too badly over the course of 6 games over 2 days. I got to see a couple of friends whom I've met through my work and my podcast. And Sue, thank you so much for the chickpea wraps. I was the envy of my teammates. Well, not really. They were eating, you know, steak and stuff. But I will be when I'm still playing in my 90s. Knock on wood. And also, hello, Jacinda. Thanks for showing up to saying hi. Great meet and greet. So garden news, I'm just looking out my window and one of the big 7-foot-high fences is down, so the deer have discovered a way in. So I'll have to go and check out what that means for all the broccoli and kale plants that we put in the ground. Getting a steady supply of greens, and that should keep us through a frost. We actually covered up. We got down to about 33. So last week before I left, I helped cover up a couple of the rows with what's that stuff called? Cloth, cover cloth, to just add a couple of degrees. Kale bounces back pretty well from light frosts, but wanted to make sure it's protected. So that's about all I got on that front. All right, time for thanks. Thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, The Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons, Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Brittany Porter, Dominic Maurer, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filkinowski, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elsbeth Feldman, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Landry, Josina, Sarah Durkas, Kelly Cameron, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franzek, Jeanette Benham, Gil Lassert, David Donahue, Blair Seiberg, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, Aviva Lael, Alicia Lemus, Val Linneman, Nick Harper, Bandana Chali, Molly Levine, The Inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, The Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Koppel, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Sharon Hirschman, Linda Ayad, Holm Hedegaard, Iza Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Lakoski of Plant Power for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Marani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Ann Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Peter W. Evans, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Emily Iaconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Picorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty DiMartino, Mike and Donna Kartz, Deanne Bishop, Bilberry Elf, Marjorie Lewis, Trisha Adams, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bayshore, Gunmarit Hagen, Tracy Gullidge, Laura Heaton, Meg from Mama Says, Stacey Stokes, Ben Savage, Michael Kay, David Hughes, Connie Rogers, Claire England, Sally Robertson, Parham Ganchi, Amy Daly, Brian Tourville, Mark Jeffrey Johnson, Josie Dempsey, Karen Schmidt, Pamela Hayden, Emily Perryman, Allison Corbett, Richard Stone, Lauren Vaught of Edible Musings, Aaron Hasty, Sean Owen, Sagar Nayak, Erica Piedra, Danielle Roberts, Michael Lushton, Sarah Johnson, Catherine Floyd, for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for now. As always, be well, my friends.